Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCBQ 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
Today we are going to be talking about Napoleon, A Life, and that's the book by Andrew Roberts, and we have the author with us. Thank you for being here, Andrew.
Thanks very much for having me on the show, Al.
This is great. What drew you into Napoleon's life enough to write a book about him?
I'd always been interested in him. I really, ever since I was a child, I think he was a fascinating character to me. I think his ambition, his sense of destiny, those aspects of him, pretty much the same as everybody else, I think.
Now, so what was his background? Like, what was his ancestry? Where did he come from?
He came from the Corsican aristocracy, a small island, of course, in the Mediterranean, which wasn't famed for its aristocracy one way or another. It was quite a rugged, mountainous area, and so not the kind of place that naturally had a aristocracy, but he was somebody who came from the upper classes of that island, whose family had been there for 300 or so years before they moved from Florence in Italy. So it was an upper class, but actually very poverty-stricken in terms of disposable income and cash.
Wow. Now, was he religious?
No, not really. He was. His father was a enlightened. He came from the sort of principles of the Enlightenment, which included those of Voltaire, which was deeply doubtful when it came to religious belief.
So, what can you tell us about his personality? What kind of a person was he?
He was profoundly driven. Man, he was very largely self-educated, but deeply educated. His father had a good library, and he read most of the books in it. He was somebody who conformed to the overall beliefs of the French Enlightenment, of people like Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who believed that the day would come sooner rather than later when the ancien regime of the French aristocracy and the monarchy, the Bourbon monarchy, would be replaced by a much more rational and logical system of government.
Did he make friends quite well, or was he more of a loner?
Yes, he did have friends when he was when he was a young man, but as he progressed, and certainly as he became more powerful and important, he really found that only the ones that were around him, the people that he needed or he could rely upon or he actually could use for his political advancement, tended to be the people he was closest to. He rather saw friendship in terms of his own thrusting, successful political nature.
And so what rose him to such power? Like, what was it about him, and how did he get there?
It was really military success. At the time of the French Revolution, he was in the French army, and because he came from he'd been a cadet in the military academy in France, when the revolution came and many of the aristocrats left France or were guillotined, were executed because of their social class, he wasn't, because he came, as I mentioned, from Corsica, which didn't have such a sort of structural class system, and so he wasn't primarily thought of as an aristocrat. And so because he was successful in the early battles that he fought on behalf of the French Revolution, he rose very, very quickly to the rank, from the ranks up to become a general by the age of 24. It was amazingly a quick advancement.
So what can you tell us? He got married and he had kids, correct?
Well, not for some time. He actually didn't meet Josephine, his first wife, until he was quite old, and until he was, well, quite old for those days, at least 30 years old, and unfortunately she was too old to have children by that stage, so he didn't have children until his second marriage, and then only one. But he did have a couple of illegitimate children by mistresses that he had once Josephine had been unfaithful to him.
Did those kids ever, did he accept them as his own, or did he sort of, shun them?
Neither. Unfortunately, he couldn't accept them as his own because of the mores of the social mores of the day, but... His one legitimate child he very much adored. He made him the King of Rome, and he tried to organize a system whereby this young lad could take over and become Emperor of France after he himself had died, but it wasn't to be.
So what was he like as an emperor, as someone that was leading the country? Was he very good with the people? Like, what can you say best about him?
He had a wonderful capacity with ordinary people, especially soldiers. He'd obviously been this junior army officer, later a senior army officer, and a very successful general. And so he was able to get on with ordinary people very well. In fact, he preferred them really to officers. He was somebody who had a sixth sense, really, also with regard to administration, and this was one of his great successes, in that he reorganized France. France had obviously suffered a debilitating revolution in 1789, and he became the dictator of France in 1799, 10 years later. And what he managed to do was to save the best bits of the French Revolution, really, and get rid of the bad bits, especially, of course, the guillotine and the Reign of Terror and the way in which it had killed 40,000 Frenchmen internally. So he was somebody who very much saw himself as father of his people.
Now his image, we always see him, and nowadays he's portrayed, he was a short man, and he had his hand in his, in his chest jacket and all that. Is his image what we see it is, or was it something different?
Well, he wasn't short for his day. He was 5'6", which was the average height of a Frenchman of his age and class and background back in the 19th century. It was early 19th century. It was very much because of the British. The British who opposed Napoleon pretty much throughout his reign caricatured him as being a small man. The great caricaturists of the time, James Gilray and Thomas Rowlandson and others, they always made him out to be very, very small, but in fact he wasn't. In fact, he only put his hand into his jacket pocket, as you mentioned. Well, not the pocket, more the waistcoat. Yes, the buttons of his waistcoat. Because he was adopting the style of the Roman emperors and the senators of Rome when they were when you saw statues of them, they often had their hands like that in their togas, and he was consciously recreating the classical stance of ancient Rome, and that was why he stood like that. It wasn't to scratch his scabies or keep his hands in his wallet or any of the other things that since have been invented about him.
Did he really idolize Rome then and the Romans?
Yes, very much. He saw the obvious precursor of the French Empire that he was trying to create as that of the Roman Empire. In a sense, and he called his upper house the Senate, and he adopted the eagle, and of course he called himself emperor. He was a great historian. He was fascinated by history, really interested in the past, and he saw Julius Caesar as his sort of greatest hero, along with possibly Alexander the Great as well. And that was why, really, he chose the imperial metaphor.
Now, how did he act with the church? That he wasn't religious, so did he have a lot of run-ins with the let's say the Catholics or anybody at the time?
Well, he didn't at the beginning. In fact, he was the one who, because the French Revolution was a profoundly atheist construct and had banned Christianity, made it illegal, closed all the churches, he was the person who, in his concordat, as it was called, with the Catholic Church in 1801, turned all that upside down and allowed the churches to be reopened, allowed Christianity back into France. And so for that reason, he had quite a good relationship with the church. But by 1809, this had soured, and his long wars and his depredations, certainly in Italy, his attempts to really fine the papal lands themselves, led him to being excommunicated by the church, and by 1809 he actually arrested the Pope and had the Pope leave Rome and come to live in under house arrest in Fontainebleau in France. And so by that stage, very clearly, the relations with the Catholic Church had gone very, very sour indeed.
Wow, that's crazy. How did the church react to the Pope being arrested?
Well, not well, as you can imagine. It, as well as excommunicating Napoleon, it ordered that nobody should have anything to do with him, which, of course, was impossible, therefore, for the French, then a profoundly Catholic country, to really follow that, because it was deeply antithetical it brought church versus state into pretty harsh disalignment, as you can imagine. Very hard for devout French Catholics to have to choose between their emperor and their pope.
Yeah. Now, is this kind of what led to his downfall, his exile?
No, not really. That was the 1812 campaign in Russia. Because of the place, the way in which he decided to retreat from Moscow in 1812, choosing the wrong route, he and his army got stuck in a series of the most terrible blizzards, which decimated his force. And for of the 615,000 men he invaded Russia with in 1812, in June of 1812, by December 1812, there were only 95,000 left alive. So it was a completely disastrous thing, which was the sort of coronary, really, that destroyed his empire. Far, far more important than loss of political support from French Catholics.
So who was it that made the decision to take him out of leadership?
Well, he himself abdicated in April 1814, so he was under enormous pressure, of course, to do so. He'd already fought a huge campaign in 1813, which had gone very badly. The one in 1814 had actually gone rather well, although it was a much smaller campaign. But nonetheless, he couldn't prevent the Allies from, by the Allies, I mean the Russians, of course, but also the Austrians and Prussians, who all came together. And meanwhile, the British were fighting in Spain and captured Spain and entered France from the south. And then in late March 1814, the Allies captured Paris. And this was the point at which, understandably, Napoleon felt he had no option but to abdicate for the first time.
So when he did, like, he got exiled to St. Helena?
No. To Elba. An island off Italy. He was exiled there, and he stayed there for 8 months. And then after seeing that the Bourbons, the French monarchists, had made such a bad job of ruling France in his absence, he then returned and marched straight on Paris, took it, the Bourbons fled, and then he fought the famous Battle of Waterloo in June 1815 and lost it. And that was the point at which he was exiled to the island of St. Helena.
So now, did he still have followers when he got exiled the second time? Was there still people that supported him?
He had a few, but nobody that, by that stage, that the 100 days, as it's called, which is the number of days between his leaving the island of Elba and losing the Battle of Waterloo and being forced to abdicate for the second time, 100,000 people have been killed or wounded as a result of that in Europe, and so his level of support pretty much totally collapsed, and that was the reason, of course, that he was forced to surrender to the British, and it was the British who took him to this very very cold and unedifying island in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean called St. Helena.
How was his life on that island? Like, what kind of life did he have?
He was fine for the first year and a half or so, when he was in exile, but then, unfortunately, he...
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
He was stricken with extremely bad cancer, and bad in that it covered all his entire stomach, but not so bad that it killed him immediately. It actually took him another 3 years to die. And so, and they didn't realize it was cancer until quite a lot later on as well. So between he got there in 1816 and didn't die until 1821, but was in an extremely bad way for certainly the last 2.5 years of his life.
So now, when he was there, there was a lot of stories, and there's even movies and things that have been made about him escaping from there.
Yes, completely impossible. He was guarded by two British frigates, which circled the island 24 hours a day. He also he was suffering from cancer for quite a lot of the time there. He had no real joie de vivre, really, no get up and go. He'd led a very adventurous life up until that point, but after the defeat at Waterloo, he no longer really had the interest or the capacity or the wherewithal to escape. There were lots of plots, actually, that French monarchists came up with, or at least imperialists in this case, came up with to try and save him. But he and a few of them, actually, were presented to him, but he turned all of them down. It wasn't something that interested in him. He was sort of really just sort of blown out by that stage, unfortunately for him.
It's funny because there's so many rumors about his death and about him escaping the island.
Well,
yeah,
they had a very intensive autopsy of him, and they found his entire stomach completely riddled with cancer. There were 7 doctors present, and it was a completely open and shut case. There was simply no way that he left that island alive. Yeah. I actually, funny enough, I've read his autopsy, and it was it seems extraordinary that anyone can doubt for a moment the method for his death.
Now, was Josephine still alive, and did she live with him on the island?
No, Josephine had died in 1815 when when he was on Elba. They'd already got divorced in 1810. His new wife, Empress Mary Louise Habsburg of Austria, was the daughter of the Emperor of Austria. And so when Austria went to war against France and Mary Louise fell into the hands of the Austrians, she had a very nice time with her father, and she took on a lover called the Graf von Nieberg, the Count von Nieberg, who later, after Napoleon died, became her husband. So she, so he was without female company on St. Helena, except insofar as he might have had an affair with the Countess Montholon, who was the wife of one of his courtiers there.
Hmm. So how do people in France see him now? Like, how is he remembered?
It depends on where you are in the political spectrum. If you're on the left in France, you you possibly see him as a monster, because he was responsible for trying to put down the slaves' revolt in Santo Domingo, modern-day Haiti. And this was done with extreme violence, and so he's thought of as being extremely harsh on the black population of Haiti. Also, the Code Napoleon that he imposed, which was the new laws for France, which were considered sexist, or indeed today are considered sexist. They weren't at the time particularly. Nonetheless, they put a lot of emphasis on the man and the patriarchy, and not on on women having rights. So if you're on the left, you also presumably think ill of Napoleon for that. And he reintroduced an aristocracy as well. So he did have a sort of hierarchical structure of society, which again was opposed to the principles of the French Revolution. If you're on the right in France, you might admire Napoleon, because he did establish meritocracy to a degree. He was somebody who believed in the religious toleration and in sort of free market capitalism to an extent, not internationally but within France. He was a reformer. He reformed all the weights and measures and things like that. He was somebody also who made France great again, in that he had, to coin a phrase, he had marched through the capitals of pretty much every European country and had won 6 out of his 7 wars. So that, or at least certainly 5 out of his 7 wars. And so for that reason, he was considered a tremendously successful conqueror. He was one of the great generals in history. And as well, personally, he was somebody with a great sense of humor. He made lots of jokes. He was somebody who was able to discuss thoughts and intellectual concepts with Goethe. And therefore was a figure unlike pretty much any other other European monarch from Elizabeth the First of England onwards, really.
So what do you think the biggest misconception that the general public have about Napoleon that you find not to be true?
Well, I think the biggest one really is that he was some kind of a proto-Hitler figure. You know, because he was undoubtedly a dictator, people think that, and because he came to grief in Russia, and that was the end of his empire, rather like it was with Hitler, that therefore he had something in common with Hitler. He had nothing whatsoever in common with Hitler. He was he was the Enlightenment on horseback. He was, as I say, somebody who supported the meritocracy. He liked Jews, got on very well with Jews. and admired them. And he really was about as unlike Adolf Hitler as possible. But unfortunately, and I don't think, by the way, that this is a feeling that I don't think people equate him with Hitler in Europe terribly much, and they don't really do it in America at all. But they certainly do it here in my country, in England.
Oh, now was there something that you were totally surprised with that you found out about his life?
I think it was his humour, actually. Very often one assumes that that great men of history aren't particularly funny, but there are a good 50 very funny Napoleon jokes in my book. I very much enjoyed researching his life and reading his letters. He wrote 30,000 letters, and you knew that it was only going to be 3 or 4 pages before you came across something amusing, and that's always very pleasing, I have to say, for a historian.
So what was his relationship like with other leaders around the world? I mean, obviously there was countries he was taking over or fighting with, but how did he do?
Those weren't always so great.
Yeah,
his relations with George III, actually, funny enough, weren't as bad as they might be, even though King George III, largely, I suppose, because he didn't ever manage to succeed to invading England. He admired George Washington enormously. He, of course, sold the Louisiana Purchase to Thomas Jefferson, but he had thought very highly of George Washington. Indeed, when Washington died, he insisted that the French court go into, I think it was 7 days of mourning. They all had to cancel any amusements they had and wear black and mourn your first president. He got on well with people like the Shah of Persia and the Sultan of Turkey. He was in that sense. And indeed, of course, he married the daughter of the Emperor of Austria. He actually personally got on very well with the Tsar of Russia until he invaded his country, of course.
So what do you think the lasting changes that he created or that he did that's still with us today?
Well, the Code Napoleon, this legal system, shorn now, obviously, of its sexist aspects, but nonetheless, it's still the underlying law of France, and not just of France, actually, of many countries that he subjugated, who worked out that it was actually a very good modern system of laws. So that still exists very much. The bridges he built and across the Seine and lots of other beautiful, major, important building works. The Arc de Triomphe, for example, that was put down under his rule, although built by a later government. His a good deal of the organisation and structure of the European Union and indeed of France can't really be understood except in terms of the Napoleonic constructs that he set up. He set up the Légion d'honneur, the great French system of honours, which still exists, the Banque de France, the Bank of France, that still exists. The Council of State still meets every Wednesday in France. There are plenty of things that have really stood the test of time and are still around 200 years after his death.
Whatever happened to his kids?
Well, not a happy story, really. His legitimate child, the King of Rome, died at the age of 21 of one of those sad and painful diseases of the day. I'm afraid I've forgotten its name.
Mm.
And then one of his other children lived to into his 60s. And another died of cancer, rather like he had, relatively young in his 50s. Tuberculosis. Mm. That was what killed his legitimate son. in 1832. So it was not a happy story with his children. There are some people who are descended from one of the illegitimate children, in fact, and I met one a few years back, and it was absolutely astonishing how much like Napoleon he looked. His face, his eyes, his lips, extremely. He could have just stepped out of a portrait of Napoleon. Quite extraordinary after two centuries.
Sitting down with Napoleon. Yeah. What do you think about his depictions in movies and in television stuff? Has anybody really got it right? Is there a movie that you think, wow, this is pretty good?
There isn't really. Actually, I once had a discussion with Martin Scorsese about it, precisely this. I said to him, why is there no great depiction of Napoleon on screen? And he said, because he's too big for any screen. And I think that might be it. Just the sheer one's sort of feeling, one's sense of Napoleon is of this enormous figure. He has been captured quite successfully, I think, a couple of times on canvas. There are paintings of him by Lefebvre that are extremely good, and David. But other than that, actually, maybe the Abel Gance depiction in the 1924 movie Napoleon, one of the first movies, really important, successful movies ever made. It's other than that, we really are still waiting for a really sort of viable, believable Napoleon on the big screen.
Yeah, do you think they're going to do one, or is he going to be too politically incorrect?
Well, my book Napoleon: A Life has been optioned three times now for TV adaptations, and so I'm living in hope that somebody will. We've come very close on a couple of occasions, so I'm keeping my fingers crossed that some genius is going to come and create something that is finally going to sort of lay the ghost to rest and produce a great Napoleon on either the big or the small screen.
Hmm. Do you think there's enough interest? Do you think they'll do it?
It's not to do with interest. There's always interest. It's always to do with money.
Yeah. Isn't that the truth? it goes down to the money. Wow. That's crazy. Well, this has been interesting. What are you working on now?
I'm working on King George III, actually. And since having written that book on Napoleon, I wrote a big book on Churchill called Churchill Walking with Destiny, which I've in fact been publicising, indeed, in Oregon a few months ago, and in 18 states of the United States, and that's taking up quite a lot of time, just going around giving speeches and talks about Winston Churchill, and then when finally I've finished that later on this year, I'm going to be concentrating on a full-scale biography of your last king, King George III.
Just fascinating. Well, it's always a pleasure to have you on. We'll have your book up on our website as well for one click, as well as the Churchill one. Any contact information for people?
It's all on my website, andrew-roberts.net.
Well, fantastic. Thank you for being here, Andrew.
That's very kind of you, Al. I've really enjoyed it. Bye-bye.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Kayla Itzinas.
I'm Kayla Itzinas, and I have been training a global community of women since 2009. I've created a brand new podcast, Sweat Daily, to help you level up your life and reach your health and well-being goals. From fitness tips to food that fuels you, meditation to motivation, we've got you covered. Sweat Daily, the happiest, healthiest, and most confident version of you awaits. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.